It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Evers administration announced this week that it has secured more than $1 billion in federal funding for broadband projects in Wisconsin. That money comes from the bipartisan infrastructure law signed by President Biden back in November of 2021.
For years, the State Public Service Commission has been working to secure this funding, but earlier this year, the Trump administration ordered states to redo the application process for the funds under new rules.
About 11% of Wisconsin lacks access to high-speed internet. That's according to a 2025 report by the Governor's Task Force on Broadband Access. Areas in northern, central, and southwest Wisconsin are especially underserved.
For a look at how Wisconsin will use the federal funds, we're joined by Alyssa Kenny, State Broadband and Digital Equity Director for the Public Service Commission. Alyssa, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me here.
So this money from a program that aims to connect every household and business to high-speed internet, where will this money go in Wisconsin?
So this money in Wisconsin is going to go to serve 175,000 different locations, including locations across all 72 counties and 8 of our 11 tribal nations. So really, there are locations throughout the entire state that are unserved. You're correct. Northern Wisconsin has more of them, but even here in Dane County and Milwaukee County, there are homes and businesses that don't have good enough internet.
So in the context of the existing state spending and the broadband projects you have been part of in recent years, how big of a deal is this $1 billion investment?
So this is a really huge deal. The state of Wisconsin has had a strong emphasis on broadband through our state grant program. And so we have been really working away at this issue for years with state broadband grants, but this federal investment is really going to reach those hardest to serve locations and the ones that have continued to be kind of on the very outskirts. And so it's an incredibly important investment because it's a high amount of money and also that it really has this universal access goal. So we're really trying to reach every last location in the state as best we can with these funds.
High amount of money. Help us trace where this money is going, who is receiving it. Can you explain that?
Sure. It's going to 29 different entities. And so you have what I would call big national carriers, so internet service providers that people are familiar with all over the country. But then you also have rural telcos that are Wisconsin-based companies that have been here for 100 years. You have some tribal nations that are building their own networks. So you have a whole variety of sort of national companies, small telephone cooperatives, and other types of entities that are receiving this funding.
This past June, as you know, the Trump administration ordered states to redo the application process, redo the bids from internet companies for this work. How has that affected Wisconsin?
So it was those were some disappointing changes for our office. We had been working really hard and we were very close to awards that would have, had a great result for Wisconsin, but the state happily complied with the new guidance. And so we had to go and rebid our BEAD program. And so that meant taking a technology neutral approach. So treating different types of technology that people get broadband through in sort of an equal playing field and just seeking the lowest cost. The other thing the state had to do is a lot of local governments had worked really hard at endorsing and sort of working with providers to indicate which providers they had a preference for working in their communities. And that was no longer allowable under the new rules. And so those were the two things that were the greatest loss for the state. That said, people came, they competed. We still had really excellent proposals. And a lot of those same providers that sort of won in the prior administration came back and won again. And there were some changes.
Were there more proposals in the second round as you redid the process?
There were more proposals. There were more proposals in the second round, yes.
So, you talked about the neutrality here of technology, going from whether it's fiber optics or satellite or wireless. If you have a bunch of these different technologies and communities around the state, is that an additional challenge to connectivity?
I don't think it's a challenge to connectivity. I think people will have some different experiences and they'll have some different costs because different technologies might have different costs or different mm-hmm. models of service. I do think, you know, there are lots of overlapping broadband networks all over the state operated by different providers with different technologies. And there's, you know, Wisconsin is a beautiful place with granite bluffs and cranberry bogs. And there's some needs for different technologies in different parts of the states. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to reach those households. Not every technology can get to every location. So a mix of technology is important for both resilience and just for sort of the geography of the state.
Really quickly here, timeline for when people will see these projects completed and when the high-speed internet will be in place.
Boy, I wish it was going to be faster, but I will say the state received our approval just Tuesday. We will start executing sort of grant agreements and the actual contracts at the beginning of next year, and there's some sort of engineering and environmental reviews. Once those grant agreements are signed, an awardee has 4 years. And so I know this sounds like a far distant date, but 2030 is really the year that all of these will be done. We do expect a number of them will come online and, you know, in 2027, and, you know, there'll be sort of sweeps of them. But really, 2030 is the estimated completion date for all of them.
Alyssa, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Alyssa Kenny is State Broadband and Digital Equity Director for the Public Service Commission. Now to look at one of those communities, we go to Tony Farrow, Executive Director of the Oneida County Economic Development Corporation, situated in Rhinelander in the Northwoods. Tony, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
What is broadband like in your area now?
Broadband is a hot topic. We've been working on that. We actually set up a committee probably in 2013 to look at broadband, and we currently have a $28 million broadband package that we're working internally with an ISP. But with that situation, we still, when that one's completed, we will only have 87% of our county covered with broadband. So with this new announcement with the BEAD funding, that should help the other 13% of my county have broadband. So it's a need for our economic growth.
So under the new rules, though, for this federal broadband program, states are meant to be neutral on the type of hookup. How could that affect Oneida County?
Well, Oneida County was in a weird situation because one of the ISPs put in a bid through the PSC and the NTIA, and they bid it through fixed wireless. Well, fixed wireless for a county like mine is something that's not preferred because we're heavy tourism. So you, in the summer months, you know, we have our population grows immensely. We have about 52% of our county is second homes. And so if you use fixed wireless, the service would not be adequate, and it would, you know, you couldn't get your 100 down, 20 up. So actually the NTIA and the PSC threw out about 5,000 and addresses in Wisconsin, 1,500 of them were in my county. So when it broke down to, we were pretty excited in Oneida County because we ended up with having all of our locations, which we'll hook up about 5,010 residents in Oneida County, and all of them will be fixed wireless to the home because we feel that's gold standard and we're really happy to have a wire to the home. And 53 of those locations will have Starlink, but out of that 5,010, only 53 will have Starlink, and the rest will have fixed wireless.
Is it clear to you?
Fixed fiber, I meant to say. It's fiber to the home. No fixed wireless in our county.
Okay. And is it clear to you how much of these federal dollars will flow your way to Oneida County?
Yeah, we're expecting somewhere close to $24 million. In this, and then with the ISP match, we're looking at the total amount through this package that we'll get about $34.8 million out of this proposal.
You lead an economic development corporation. How does internet access impact the economic well-being of your area?
Yeah, it's really important. We did a study because we have a lot of second homes, like I mentioned earlier, and people with second homes, they spend between, you know, 3 to 5 weeks a year in their homes up here, vacationing and enjoying the Northwoods. If they have internet in their homes, we show that they will stay 2 to 3 weeks longer than that. So if you're talking about half of the houses in Oneida County being second homes, and you say that they stay an extra 2 or 3 weeks up in our county, that's money being spent at our stores, our restaurants, other services, and that is a huge economic help to the Northwoods in my area. So it's critical that we have that for our economic stability.
And to be clear here, the topography, the trees, that has been a challenge here to get high-speed internet and make that possible for the whole county. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. We also have a lot of marshy, swampy area, a lot of rocks, that type of situation. So it's a huge issue, especially the western side of my county. We don't have broadband. Majority of the people out of that 13% of my county that doesn't have broadband, they are a lot of them on the west side of Oneida County.
Timeline.
Very rocky and hard to get to.
Very rocky, hard to get to. And timeline here, when do you expect to see results of this federal investment?
Well, our current program, we hope to see with the $28 million we're currently doing, we hope to have a lot of that finished next year or by 2027. And then with the current program we're talking about with the BEAD program, we're hoping to see people breaking ground late summer to early spring 2027. Through this program, your earlier person mentioned, we did all the resolutions and stuff with the BEAD Bob. We picked our provider. The provider that we originally picked to be in our county did not get awarded the funds. It was a different ISP provider. So right now I have 4 ISP providers in my county, and with this new BEAD program, I'll have a 5th provider that's coming in to put in. This new internet provider was given 3,227 locations in my county.
Tony, thank you for joining us for the update.
Thank you.
Tony Farrow, Executive Director of the Oneida Economic Development Corporation. BEAD, by the way, stands for Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. Earlier, we heard from Melissa Kenny, State Broadband and Digital Equity Director for the Public Service Commission.
Coming up, when a community faces drinking water contamination or an aging well, it can cost millions of dollars to fix the problem. Hear from village administrators getting relief through a loan program.
Our village doesn't take in very much, and it would take us 40 years to come up with $3 million to put into a new well.
How municipalities tackle big infrastructure bills, that's next.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. When a community faces drinking water contamination or has an aging well system, it can cost millions of dollars to fix that problem.
For the hundreds of villages here in Wisconsin, those projects can make up a huge part of their annual budget and force them to take on significant debt to provide clean drinking water to residents.
Recently, the Evers administration announced over $280 million in financial assistance for Wisconsin municipalities through the state's Safe Drinking Water Loan Program.
We're checking in now on a pair of village projects that received funding through the program. Matt Gantenbein is village president of Dickeyville, and Sandy Kulik is village administrator for Hales Corners. Matt and Sandy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Matt, starting with you, I understand that Dickeyville, so this village in the southwest corner of the state, is planning to construct a new well. What is driving that need for your community?
Well, our well that we currently have right now was installed in 1950, and it just isn't the what we need right now for our residents of Dickeyville. We needed something that's going to be able to supply a lot more water for the demand that we need.
Dickeyville only has about 900 residents. How hard is it to get an infrastructure project off the ground?
Well, it takes years of planning. We kind of been looking at this for about the last 3 years, I believe. And now with all the industrial coming to town, you know, it kind of puts a burden on what we do have and need to upgrade our wells that we do have right now. Like our well, we have two wells currently in town, and one went down last year for our 10-year checkup on that well, and it was down, and we blew pumps in our good well that was put in 1967. So we couldn't just rely on our number one well. We needed to we need well two as well, but when well two went down, our well one was working extremely hard.
Mm. And so for heavy industry to come to town, for you to get more businesses, more jobs, you need these wells to be in very good working order.
100% correct. I mean, if you don't have the supply that they need, you know, they're going to look elsewhere to go. And we're sitting in a really good spot right now with businesses coming over, coming down, and relocating their businesses. And if you don't have the needs that they do need, it's not going to be worth their time or their efforts to put their money into the village.
And Sandra, turning to Hales Corners in Milwaukee County, you're dealing with PFAS contamination in the water. How big of an issue is this for your residents?
So ours is kind of a backward system. The village of Hales Corners doesn't own the water utility. Anybody that is connected to municipal water is through a agreement from 1974 with Milwaukee Water Works. So there's pockets of the village that have private well systems, like individual homes. And then we had three. We now only have one more left after this project that had a municipal well system. So ours is it's called the Hales Happiness Water Trust. It was established in 1952 or something like that. They had three wells. Well one went down. Well two was contaminated with PFAS, and it backflowed into well number one, contaminating that one. Oh. So they basically were operating about 188 homes approximately in where a small municipality of about 8,000 people were affected. So a good chunk of the city, very, very population dense area, was regulated by the DNR because they serve more than 50 customers. So the well failed in June of 2023. It failed a DNR water test. And the members of the trust came to us asking for help. So it's like, okay, your options are to convert to Milwaukee Water. It's all we have.
And Milwaukee Water Works has been testing drinking water for PFAS since 2008. What do you think of that monitoring window? I mean, is that a long time to be attentive to forever chemicals in drinking water?
Probably, except that, again, this system wasn't owned by Milwaukee Water Works. It's only regulated by the DNR.
Ah.
Once we complete it, it's a private well system owned by these 188 homes. Or was. Mm. So our project is different than any other one. There's, I believe, across the entire state, there's only 9 of these left, these private water systems that are regulated utilities that are owned privately, not by the municipality. Mm. So we have these individual little houses that I wish there was some platform for them to get their individual wells tested, but their only option would be the same. They'd have to connect to Milwaukee Water, and without having a significant number of parcels, that's going to be very expensive.
Matt, has your community in Dickeyville been dealing with contaminants in water, and what are the source points?
No, we haven't had any of that where there's contaminants or whatnot. Mm. But we have been doing our regular DNR, phosphorus, and all that, up to date, So as far as contaminants go, no, we're not in any state of that.
You know, I think about how for a village, and you need, say, Matt, a new well, you have to have the expertise to write the RFPs and to analyze the bids that come in and do that very closely, and you have to be able to write the grants. And I wonder for both of you, are these administrative areas a challenge to do as a village? Matt, you first.
Well, I'll tell you, us having Delta 3 engineering group they help us an extremely, extremely a ton with on what we can apply for, what we can apply for. And between all that of what our needs are, we put our needs ahead of everything and then focus on, all right, this needs to be done ASAP, or we wait until further down the road. So we put one of those binders all together to make sure that we're doing the right thing at the right time. But this well is needed. We can't go, what if well two breaks down and well one won't work? We won't be able to pass the water out to everybody that off of well one, you know, like we absolutely needed two wells, and it's time that we move forward with our third well.
Sandy, how about for you in Hales Corners? have you had to be an expert in so many different areas?
So I've been in municipal government for 29 years and gathered people along the way. So I relied on previous people that I worked with to help me through some of this. I contacted another municipality, actually in Waukesha County, that I used to work for. I drafted an RFP and asked him to look it over. He's a certified engineer managing a much larger community going, he goes, holy cow, what is this? So this is my nightmare. And when someone who manages a population of 70,000 looks at my tiny little village and goes, wow, this is a monster project, I kind of tend to take his word for it. So I wrote it, had him review it, and then I asked Milwaukee Water to review, just to get the design team required, an RFP. And so I had Milwaukee Water make sure that I was meeting all of their criteria. When our project is complete, we turn it over to Milwaukee Water, and we don't even own the system anymore. So they had to be involved in it too. So they helped me review it. And then when it came to design selection, like picking the design firm, we ended up with Ari Smith, who's done projects with us multiple times in the past and always been a good player. So we were fortunate that they came in as the low bid on the design. And they drafted all of the actual construction documents. So I just had to write the RFP for the design firm.
Mm. We are talking about the challenges in funding drinking water projects for small Wisconsin communities. And we have Dickeyville Village President Matt Gantenbein in the southwest corner of the state and Hales Corners Village Administrator there, Sandy Kulik, in Milwaukee County. Matt, how expensive is it to build a new well? And how does that price tag compare to what you have in the village budget?
So our village budget, we only work on, I believe it's a $400,000 budget. So it's not like we have money just sitting somewhere to, you know, be able to pull from. But $3 million is what the estimated cost is supposed to be. So,
and where will you get that funding?
Well, we got a low interest loan and then the safe drinking water grant.
The safe drinking water loan program.
Yeah.
Has that program made an impact for your village? What is it like to receive funding through that program?
Oh, without them, we wouldn't be able to do, you know, what we do. Like I said, our village doesn't take in very much, and to be able to come up with $3 million, like, it would take us 40 years to come up with $3 million to put into a new well.
Sandy, what is it like connecting to a water system? I mean, that can't be cheap as well for Hales Corners. What does your funding look like?
So because of the nature of the project and the convoluted way we had to go... The ownership was a big issue, big problem. So the interpretation of the emerging contaminant grant that we were looking to apply for took us almost 18 months from we were ready to literally start letting that project, and we were still trying to figure out who would actually be the person applying for that funding. So there was some interpretations of language in the bipartisan infrastructure law bill and the emerging contaminant grant thing that said only the owner could apply for it. Well, the water trust doesn't qualify because they're not municipal. We didn't technically qualify because we aren't the ultimate owners. Milwaukee Water wouldn't do it. So it became kind of a problem. We ended up working through Ron Johnson's office, Brian Stiles, and a local our local state congressman to help us get this figured out. And it took them about 3 days once we found out how to fix it that they assisted us with getting it corrected so we could apply. Our total amount of, for the just the water piece of this project, the village borrowed over $8 million for this project. About $5 million of that was for, which you saw from the governor's notice, was for the water main private side connections and the water main itself. So 50% of it would be covered under the emerging contaminant grant, which is 100% principal forgiveness. We borrowed money in May of 25 to get this project going. If we didn't receive the funding, the neighbors would have been special assessed around $35,000 per household.
Wow.
To get that water up and running. With the emergent contaminant grant, that drops in half. And then the other half of the funding is through the same thing, the Safe Drinking Loan Program. So then they have 10 years to pay off that. This is a larger community, but not particularly affluent. And response to Dickie Villa said, there doesn't matter what size you are, the state levy limit laws kind of put us all in the same place trying to figure out how to do all these things that need to be done. They're not wants, they're needs. We have to fix these things. So that's kind of what we ended up doing. We borrowed the money in May of 25 on a one-year note. When the grant proceeds are hopefully awarded, which I believe they are now, then we'll use that to pay off that one-year note. Half of it goes away, and the other half is special assessed over 10 years. So we could not have done this project without, we would have had to borrow money no matter what. And if we would have had to refund that note, it would have hamstrung our debt levy capacity for a decade, for 10 years without that money. That's a tremendous impact, not just on the people in the Water Trust, but on the entire village as a whole.
For both of these projects, Matt and Sandy, I'm wondering if you can look at this on the other side once they're completed and what impact they'll make to quality of life in your villages. Matt, you first.
Well, like I said, it'll help our residents in town immensely. So that they don't have to continue to, you know, we don't have to continue to go to the residents and keep raising rates, you know. And then secondly, for these industries that come in, you know, with knowing that we have capable water that can get to them, you know, they're gonna choose us to come here. And we're sitting in a really good spot right now. But we're probably 20 years away before we notice an impact to where the village working on a $400,000 budget might be working with a $3 million budget. You know, it's all right there.
Mm. How about for you, Sandy, in Hales Corners, very close to Milwaukee? What might this project being completed do for your community?
For those homes, prior to when the Hales Happiness Trust was doing its thing, a 70-year-old water system was consistently failing. Water mains tore up the streets. They didn't have water. The water smelled. It was brown. So every home in there, and I don't want to say regardless of the price tag, but even with half of the full cost, their property values are going to skyrocket because they have clean, safe, reliable drinking water. And it's a very dense corner. Like, all of those properties are the smallest population or the smallest lot size in the village. They're all quarter acre lots. So it's a very dense area to have all be drawing off of one aquifer that was contaminated. Mm-hmm. So it'll improve not just their quality of life, it improves their asset value. They couldn't, from my understanding of this water contamination issue, you couldn't even grow garden vegetables because it would be in the vegetables. There were issues with washing your dog. So if you can't wash your dog with it, what is it doing to you when you're bathing in it?
What is your advice to other villages, other small Wisconsin communities that have either contamination or 70-year-old infrastructure water systems that need replacing?
This is the only option you've got. If you've got debt capacity, you're going to have to borrow for it. There's no way around it. The funds from the state are limited and getting a little harder to apply for. I think this cycle, and I don't want to speak for Dickieville, but it was normally a pretty competitive grant cycle. So he touched on the planning of it, 3 years in the planning. Plan for these things, have a 10-year capital plan, decide where you need to go and what must be done, and prioritize those things. And it sounds like that's what they did. And that's what, frankly, we've been doing here for years. We've got a 5 and a 10-year capital plan. This was never on our radar because we don't own water. So when it comes to everything else, if you own, most municipalities own their water system and they're a regulated utility, and hopefully they're paying attention to those things.
Matt, in closing here, do you have any advice for other villages?
Yeah, like I said, you know, I'll touch back on it, you know, plan. You can't just go for the year. You know, we have 2 year terms here, you know, and that's the other thing is you have the turnover rate. You need to keep looking like 10 years down the road, you know, otherwise it's going to bite you, you know, like, and that goes for like streets and all that, you know, and I know that we're not on streets, but with that water and taking advantage of the grant monies that are out there, you know, you need to put your town out there, village out there to be able to plan and put it noticeable for the grants that are available.
Well, Sandy and Matt, thank you so much for sharing your projects and for joining us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
That is Matt Gantenbein, village president of Dickeyville in the southwest corner of the state, and Sandy Kulik, village administrator for Hales Corners in Milwaukee County. They spoke about their water projects that are receiving funding from the state's Safe Drinking Water Loan Program.
Still to come, there have been more and more discoveries of ancient canoes in the bed of Madison's Lake Mendota, as much as 5,000 years old. And archaeologists say the canoes are part of a bigger story.
We're seeing a parking lot, a node on a larger transportation system.
That's coming up next. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Historical Society recently announced that 6 more ancient dugout canoes have been found in Lake Mendota in the Madison area this year. That brings the total to 16 canoes, including one that is believed to be 5,000 years old.
Now, archaeologists are working together with tribal historians to piece together the puzzle of the cultural history revealed by these canoes.
And the Historical Society has been awarded a new national grant to preserve 2 of them to be displayed in the new Wisconsin History Center that's opening in 2027.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist for the Wisconsin Historical Society, and Larry Plusinski is Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Larry, thanks for joining us.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
And Tamara, good to talk to you again.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me back.
Tamara, let's start with you. A part of the team that unearthed that dugout canoe that made headlines back in 2021. Well, now hold on. Lots more since then, including this batch of 6. What if anything, does this change our understanding of how people were using this Lake Mendota waterway?
Well, there's a lot that's changed from our original find in 2021. We had constructed a story about a guy that was using it that was a fisherman because we found some net sinkers in it. And we figured that it was 1,200 years old. It was connected to the mound-building culture that was around the Four Lakes area. And we made up this story about it being lost. It had a hole in the bottom and been lost in the bottom of Lake Mendota. And, well, we started finding more canoes. The next year, we found one that was 3,000 years old. There was one right next to it that was 2,000 years old. When we removed the 3,000-year-old canoe, there was one underneath it that was 4,500 years old. And they're all in the same depth of water. They're in 24 feet of water off the village of Shorewood Hills. And what that led us to believe is that these are parked on an ancient shoreline. From there, we started looking again the next year, finding more, moving our number up to about 8. We looked inside the conservation tank that where we're doing the preservation work on the first canoe and the second canoe. And we noticed that the wood that came up with some of those, we were told to bring up wood that was that had been worked by man in some way, that had charring or scraping on it, and it those were of different wood species, and they looked different. They had a different texture to them. So we had those analyzed as well. So now we're up to 10, and then this spring, of course, 6 more, and the oldest one being 5,200 years old.
Tamara, I know archaeologically and historically, some cultures, when they run into water, it's a border, it's an obstacle, and others, it's a highway. What are we learning about this, about the people who lived along these lakes?
Well, because all of these canoes are really parked in the same area, we're seeing a parking lot. Mm-hmm. So this is a parking lot on an ancient shoreline. They're parked in front of ravines that cut through about a 35-foot bluff on the south shore of Lake Mendota. And what we're seeing here is they're likely parking them here as they came across the lake when the lake levels were way down. This was a period of prolonged drought. And they park them there in order to walk to other village sites or sacred sites that were in the Four Lakes area. So this is a node on a larger transportation system.
Larry, as a tribal historic preservation officer for the Bad River Band, what do these new discoveries mean for you?
It just goes to show that we had covered a vast area. Story tells us that we traveled from the East Coast westward until we found food that grows on water, which took us many generations to get here. And we didn't have tribal names at all. We were all indigenous. Like when we spread up through Wisconsin and everything else, it just shows that we traveled either by land or by water. And these canoes just go to show you how many years ago that we have traveled and how far we have ventured.
Larry, Bad River, you're in northwestern Wisconsin. These particular canoes in the south central part of the state, but I understand you personally have been involved in this canoe project very closely. What kind of connections do you feel as you come down here and see these canoes from further south in the state and you're spanning literally thousands of years?
Well, let's see. After the goosebumps settled, it was just a sight to behold. It was I was glad I was invited to be part of this journey. It just opens up my eyes of how my ancestors have traveled, not only the riverways and the smaller lakes, but also Lake Superior to get to their destination. So every time I go down there, every time I look at these canoes, I just close my eyes and think back. If I was back there, where would I be going? What would I be doing? How would I be surviving? And it just gathers me more knowledge of how my ancestors survived and lived.
Tamara, one challenge here is these are things made of wood. And I understand archaeologically, well, ceramics, they last a nice long time. Metal, sure, sometimes teeth and bone. Wood, though, what is it about the conditions under Lake Mendota that preserve these canoes?
Well, they had been buried for thousands of years, and what we're seeing in this area is that they're starting to erode out of that shoreline, out of a wall that drops down between 14 and 35 feet deep. And so they had been covered in sediment for this whole time and preserved. But we do see wood breaking down. We see a vast difference between the canoe number one, the 1,200-year-old canoe. That one, when we brought it up, it had some cellular structure still left to it. It felt almost like a bagel, like it was hard on the outside and kind of spongy on the inside. But when we got to the 3,000-year-old canoe, it was the consistency almost of wet cardboard. It had the shape underwater as it was positioned in the sediment of a canoe, but as we brought it up, it very easily broke apart. And so now it's in a number of pieces, which were planned through the conservation process of putting back together. Now, the 5,200-year-old canoe, and that's absolutely spongy. And so you see that survivability of wood really change over time. Now, will we be able to find a 7,000-year-old canoe? Because by looking at the core samples that were done in Lake Mendota, that prolonged drought lasted from 7,500 years ago to about 700 years ago or so. And really with the last 1,000 years of that being a fluctuation in the water coming up and going down over time. And really the canoes are representative of what that those sort of micro environmental events were. So will we be able to find that 7,000-year-old canoe? Maybe, if we keep looking. And I sure hope so, because it's just such a treat to be able to connect this and to connect this tangible thing that we're finding on the environment with the indigenous people of Wisconsin.
We're talking about a new round of ancient dugout canoes found in Lake Mendota in Madison. Tamara Thompson is with us, maritime archaeologist for the Wisconsin Historical Society, and Larry Plusinski, tribal historic preservation officer for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. All right, Tamara, we've got these canoes. What happens with them now? How many are we preserving? How many, I guess, are we putting back where we found them?
So The two that were brought up in 2021 and 2022 are undergoing a conservation process. They're in a tank right now filled with polyethylene glycol. So what happens with waterlogged wood is that the only thing that's holding the cellular structure up is the water itself. So as you bring them out of the water and that water evaporates off or drains out, the wood will check and fold in on itself and become flaky. So we're bulking it back up with an agent called polyethylene glycol. So again, this is something that it's a food grade product. We eat it every day. If you eat Skittles, you've eaten polyethylene glycol. It's the same thing we're soaking these canoes in. They'll be finished with that process of the bulking agent in a matter of a couple months, and then we're planning on sending the canoes down to Texas. There's a conservation facility down at Texas A&M University that does freeze drying, and they'll freeze off any remaining water that is within the cellular structure of the wood. And then they'll be brought back to Wisconsin, and at least one of the canoes will be put on display at the new Wisconsin History Center, which is due to open in 2027. Now, as far as the other canoes, we've taken wood samples from them only. So those wood samples are sent to Forest Products Laboratory on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, and there we have wood type analysis done. So we're able to look at all of the different taxa of wood, which are represented in the Lake Mendota collection. But then we also take part of that sample and we send it away for radiocarbon dating. And that's how we're getting the dates on the canoes. So as far as any of the other things that have come up, they're not coming up. They're going to remain in place. And in fact, we work with the tribal historic preservation officers from across Wisconsin. And that was really the consensus, is that we're learning a lot from the site by leaving all the canoes in place and really understanding what's going on there and how many more canoes may be here that are telling us about the use of canoes and that intermodal connection that happens when they're transitioning from parking their canoes to walking on the landscape.
Larry, as a tribal historic preservation officer, there is a history where archaeologists don't always work well with tribes across the United States. This sounds like a real cooperative effort. Can you talk a little bit about the partnership between you and other historic preservation officers and then the archaeologists like Tamara?
Well, with the other 11 tribes across Wisconsin, we meet quarterly to discuss a whole variety involving everything in Indian country in Wisconsin. And with that, every tribe representative has a chance to speak. And between Bill Quackenbush from the Ho-Chunk Nation and myself, we're the only two that really had a keen interest in what the Historical Society was doing. Him and I started talking, and he invited me down. And I was just, as I should say, giddy over the possibility of, you know, being going down there and just learning more about our ancestors. So with that, everything that I learned down there, I bring up and I come before my council and I talk to them about what's going on in our country with the canoes and that, and just to get their involvement. And they are just all surprised that, you know, that the canoes are being found and the history that is being that we collaborate with the Historical Society with of what the possibilities of how this all gelled together and came about. So every time we get together, we learn something new. Every time I open an email from Tamara or Cecil, I get excited because I know something's up. Something's going to happen. So I'm just so blessed to be part of this.
Now, Tamara, if we're finding all these in Lake Mendota, it's not the only lake in Wisconsin. We've got lots of them. Where else have we found these, or where else might we be looking for these dugout canoes?
Well, there's a larger project that we've been working on since 2018, along with Dr. Cecil Schrader at the University of Wisconsin, and we're collecting information on canoes that are across the state. So these are ones starting out, it had been ones that were in small historical society collections, in people's basements, in their garages, basements, and everywhere across the state. We've also started looking in waters. So as there have been known that they're reported in lakes or rivers, we'll go try to find them again, and then again try to get a wood sample of them to understand what's going on. Now, have we found other caches? No. We know of a couple different sites through the literature. There was supposedly one on the Lemonware River. We have not been able to relocate that. There was supposedly one that's up at Lake Nockabay in Marinette County, and we have not been able to find that. But have we looked? Yes, we have. And we believe that there's more out there. And if people know where canoes are located underwater, or if they have them in their garages, basements, or barns, they should let us know, and they can just send an email to the State Historical Society, and we'll definitely add those to our understanding of canoes across the state.
Larry, there is some luck here involved in, you know, what kind of conditions preserve these canoes. Are you hopeful that, hey, maybe someday we'll be talking to you about canoes found in your part of the state?
I sure wish we would. I know Lake Superior, you know, if something is buried in there, it's going to, as cold as Lake Superior is, it's going to be preserved as long as it's covered. And who knows what these storms lately, the erosion and everything, it could be a great possibility of something being uncovered.
And Tamara, I assume winter is not your main diving season. What are your plans, though, when things open up in the spring?
Oh, we dive year round.
Oh, you do. Okay.
Yeah, so we've also been known to go out on the ice and look with ground penetrating radar, with Bill Quackenbush and representatives from the Ho-Chunk Nation. Also, Larry came down for that. We used ground penetrating radar to sort of understand the signature of the dugout canoes in Lake Mendota, so that we could look elsewhere and begin looking elsewhere for that using their ground penetrating radar.
Interesting.
Yeah, so there's opportunity. I don't just sit at my desk all winter long waiting for summer to come along. There's lots to do.
We'll leave it there. Tamara, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Larry, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, Martin, welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Tamara Thompson, maritime archaeologist for the Wisconsin Historical Society, and Larry Plusinski, tribal historic preservation officer for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. We've been talking about six more ancient dugout canoes recently found in Madison's Lake Mendota this year, including one estimated to be more than 5,000 years old. A new movie shares the story of Lightning and Thunder, the Milwaukee-based Neil Diamond tribute band.
Song Sung Blue stars Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson as the couple Mike and Claire Sardina. It had a special advanced screening this week in Milwaukee.
The real-life Claire Sardina joins us for an interview that'll air later this month, and we want to hear from any Lightning and Thunder fans out there.
Did you ever see them perform? Were you a fan? You can share your memories with us, and we can, in turn, share them here on the show.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232.
Welcome Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Lauren Cox, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.